This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Bush at War, Inside the Bush White House, by Bob Woodward. Read by James Naughton.
I'm Bob Woodward. This is an account of President George W. Bush at war during the first 100 days after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. The information I obtained for this book includes contemporaneous notes taken during more than 50 National Security Council and other key meetings where the most important decisions were discussed and made. Many direct quotations of the President and the War Cabinet members come from those notes. In addition, I interviewed more than 100 people involved in the decision-making and the execution of the war, including President Bush, key War Cabinet members, the White House staff, and officials currently serving at various levels of the Defense and State Departments, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Most of the interviews were conducted on background, meaning that I could use the information, but the sources would not be identified by name in this book. I have attributed thoughts, conclusions, and feelings to the participants. These come either from the person himself, a colleague with direct knowledge of them, or the written record, both classified and unclassified. President Bush was interviewed on the record twice, once for 90 minutes by myself and Dan Baltz, a colleague at the Washington Post, for a lengthy 8-part series called 10 Days in September, which was published in the Washington Post in early 2002. I have drawn on that interview and the series for a portion of this book. I interviewed President Bush a second time on August 20th, 2002, at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, for 2 hours and 25 minutes. The transcript shows that I asked questions or made short comments 300 times. The President gave specific answers, often very detailed, about his reactions and reasoning behind the main decisions and turning points in the war. War planning and war making involve secret information. I have used a good deal of it trying to provide new, specific details without harming sensitive operations or relations with foreign governments. And I have used first names only to identify CIA officers who are still operating undercover. But this is not a sanitized version, and the censors, if we had them in the United States, thank God we don't, would no doubt draw the line at a different, more restrictive place than I have. This book is an inside account. Largely the story is the insiders saw it, heard it, and lived it. Since it covers events and secret deliberations that began just over a year ago, it is an early version. But I was able to test the information I had for accuracy and context with trusted sources I have known for years, and in some cases, decades. Criticism, the judgments of history, and other information may, over the coming months and years, alter the historical understanding of this era. This is my effort to get the best obtainable version of the truth. In 1991, I published a book called The Commanders, which was about the 1989 invasion of Panama by the United States and the lead-up to the Gulf War during the presidency of Bush's father, President George Herbert Walker Bush. I wrote at the beginning of that book the following. The decision to go to war is one that defines a nation, both to the world and, perhaps more importantly, to itself. There is no more serious business for a national government, no more accurate measure of national leadership. That is truer today than perhaps ever.
Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, began as one of those spectacular pre-fall days on the East Coast. Sunny temperatures in the 70s, light winds, the sky a vivid light blue. With President George W. Bush traveling in Florida that morning, promoting his education agenda, his intelligence chief, CIA Director George J. Tenet, didn't have to observe the 8 a.m. ritual of personally briefing the president at the White House on the latest and most important top-secret information flowing into America's vast spy empire. Instead, Tenet, 48, a hefty outgoing son of Greek immigrants, was having a leisurely breakfast at the St. Regis Hotel, 3 blocks north of the White House, with the man who was most responsible for his rise in the world of secret intelligence, former Oklahoma Democratic Senator David L. Boren. The two had struck up an unusually close friendship, going back 13 years, when Tenet was a mid-level staffer on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which Boren chaired. Boren recommended Tenet to President-elect Bill Clinton in 1992, urging that he be appointed to head the administration's transition team on intelligence. By 1997, Clinton charged Tenet with heading the CIA and the vast U.S. intelligence community. In early 2001, Boren called President-elect Bush, praising Tenet as nonpartisan and urging him to keep him on as CIA director. "Ask your father," he suggested. When the younger Bush did, the former President George H.W. Bush said, "From what I hear, he's a good fellow," one of the highest accolades in the Bush family lexicon. The former president also told his son, "The most important thing you'll do as president every day is get your intelligence briefing." Tenet had developed an understanding of the importance of human intelligence, humant, in spycraft. In an era of dazzling breakthroughs in signals intelligence and overhead satellite photography and radar imagery, the CIA had downgraded the role of humant. But Tenet earmarked more money for human intelligence and the training of case officers, the clandestine service operatives who work undercover, recruiting and paying spies and agents in foreign governments, called sources or assets. At one point in the 1990s, only 12 case officers were being trained for the future in the year-long intensive program at the CIA facility called The Farm in the Virginia countryside. In 2001, Tenet had 10 times as many in training. It was designed to increase humant and make covert action, if authorized by the president, possible. All this had been done during the Clinton years. "What are you worried about these days?" Boren asked Tenet that morning. "Bin Laden," Tenet replied, referring to terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, an exiled Saudi who was living in Afghanistan and had developed the worldwide network Al-Qaeda, Arabic for the base. He was convinced that bin Laden was going to do something big, he said. "Oh, George," Boren said. For the last 2 years, he had been listening to his friend's concerns about bin Laden. "How could one private person, without the resources of a foreign government, be such a threat?" he asked. "You don't understand the capabilities and the reach of what they're putting together," Tenet said. Recently, Tenet had worried that there would be attacks during the July 4, 2001 celebration. Though he didn't disclose it to Boren, there had been 34 specific communications intercepts among various bin Laden associates that summer making declarations such as, "Zero hour is tomorrow," or "Something spectacular is coming." Nothing had happened, but Tenet said it was the issue he was losing sleep over. Suddenly, several of Tenet's security guards were bolting toward the table. "Mr. Director," one of them said, "there is a serious problem. The World Trade Tower has been attacked." One of them handed Tenet a cell phone, and he called headquarters. "So they put the plane into the building itself?" Tenet asked incredulously. "This has Bin Laden all over it," Tenet told Boren. "I've got to go." As Tenet hopped in his car to go to the 258-acre CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, the past, present, and future of his counterterrorism efforts were swirling in his head. The CIA had been after Bin Laden for more than 5 years, and increasingly so, after the devastating 1998 Bin Laden-sponsored terrorist bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania that had left more than 200 people dead. At that time, President Clinton directed the U.S. military to launch 66 cruise missiles into terrorist training camps in Afghanistan where Bin Laden was believed to be in a high-level meeting. But he had apparently left a few hours before the missiles arrived. In 1999, the CIA commenced a covert operation to train 60 commandos from the Pakistani intelligence agency to enter Afghanistan to capture Bin Laden. But the operation was aborted because of a military coup in Pakistan. One option that had been considered was a clandestine helicopter-borne night assault on Bin Laden with a small elite U.S. military special forces unit of roughly 40 men. The military said a raid on Bin Laden might fail and could involve substantial U.S. casualties. Intelligence reports also showed that Bin Laden had his key lieutenants keep their families with the entourage, and Clinton was opposed to any operation that might kill women and children. A U.S. Special Forces unit and U.S. submarines capable of firing cruise missiles were put on alert, but they required 6 to 10 hours advance warning about Bin Laden's future location. One of the most guarded secrets in the CIA was the existence of 30 recruited Afghan agents operating under the code word GE Seniors, who had been paid to track Bin Laden around Afghanistan for the last 3 years. Incredibly, the seniors seemed to have him located most of the time, but they were never able to provide actionable intelligence, to say with any confidence that he would remain there for the time needed to shoot cruise missiles at the location. And the CIA failed to recruit a reliable human spy in Bin Laden's circle who could tip them to his plans. Neither Clinton nor Bush, to this moment, had given the CIA lethal authority to send the seniors or other paid CIA assets to kill or assassinate Bin Laden. The presidential ban on assassination, first signed by President Gerald Ford, had the force of law. Tenet figured the CIA had done everything they knew how to do. But he had never requested a change in the rules, had never asked Clinton for an intelligence order that would have permitted the seniors to ambush Bin Laden. The lawyers at the Justice Department or the White House, he believed, would have said no, that it would have violated the assassination ban. What the rules did permit was for the CIA to seize Bin Laden and turn him over to law enforcement, an operation legally known as a rendering. But all the CIA experts in the Directorate of Operations thought it would not work, that it would lead to a lot of people getting killed, and not necessarily Bin Laden. And Tenet agreed. The plan never went further. By 9:50 a.m., Tenet was in his seventh-floor office. Two commercial passenger airliners had already struck both World Trade Center towers, and a third had hit the Pentagon. A fourth hijacked plane was over Pennsylvania, apparently heading for the Washington area. Reports were swamping the system, saying that future targets included the White House, the Capitol, and the State Department. CIA headquarters, a highly visible and recognizable landmark near the Potomac River, was a possible target. Investigators knew that Ramzi Youssef, an al-Qaeda terrorist who was responsible for the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, had had plans to fly a plane packed with explosives into the CIA buildings. "We have to save our people," Tenet told his senior leadership. "We have to evacuate the building." Kofor Black, the head of the CTC, the Counterterrorism Center, looked on this order with skepticism. At 52, Black was a veteran covert operator and one of the agency's legends. He had helped in the 1994 capture of Carlos the Jackal, perhaps the most notorious pre-Bin Laden international terrorist. "Sir," Black said, "we're going to have to exempt CTC from this because we need to have our people working the computers." "Well," Tenet said, "the Global Response Center," he was referring to the eight people on watch on the sixth floor, near the top of the building, who monitored the latest intelligence on terrorism throughout the world, "they're going to be at risk. This is an element. We're going to have to keep them in place." "Well, we have to get those people out," Tenet insisted. "No, sir, we're going to have to leave them there, because they have a key function to play in a crisis like this. This is exactly why we have the Global Response Center." "Well, they could die." "Sir, then they're just going to have to die." Tenet paused. The CIA director was a sort of father protector to the thousands who worked there. "You're absolutely right," Tenet finally told Black. The rules, maybe all of them, had changed that morning. Thousands were already dead in New York City and at the Pentagon. Tenet ordered the building evacuated, except for those in the Global Response Center. In Lima, Peru, that morning, Secretary of State Colin L. Powell had just sat down to breakfast with the new president, Alejandro Toledo. Powell was attending an Organization of American States meeting. Suddenly, the door opened, and Craig Kelly, Powell's executive assistant, rushed in with a note written on a piece of paper that had been ripped out of a spiral wire notepad. Two airplanes had crashed into the World Trade Center. "Two is not an accident," Powell realized. "I've got to go home." It would take about an hour to get the plane ready, so Powell stopped by the conference. Other foreign ministers made speeches of sympathy. Powell spoke briefly. "A terrible, terrible tragedy has befallen my nation," he said. "But you can be sure that America will deal with this tragedy in a way that brings those responsible to justice." The others stood and applauded. Powell then raced to the airport for the 7-hour flight. Once the plane took off, Powell found that he couldn't talk to anybody because his communications were connected to the system in the U.S., which was swamped. Without a phone or his email, he was like a man without a country. After a few minutes, he went to the front of the plane to call over the radio. That meant over and out, non-secure communications. He reached Richard L. Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, and his best friend. They spoke several times, but real talk was hopeless. Armitage, a 1967 Naval Academy graduate, had served 4 tours in Vietnam and later as an Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He was an outspoken, muscular, barrel-chested man who deplored fancy-pants, pinstriped diplomatic talk. "I would trust him with my life, my children, my reputation, everything I have," Powell said of Armitage. Of all the things Powell hated, being out of the action was at the top of the list. A central part of national security policymaking was crisis management. Crisis provided the greatest danger and the greatest opportunity. At 64, Powell had already sat in 3 of the seats in the White House Situation Room: National Security Advisor to President Reagan for a year, then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the first President Bush during the Gulf War, and now Secretary of State to the new Bush for the last 9 months. A report came that another airliner had hit the Pentagon. Powell started to scribble notes to himself. Ever the soldier, he wrote, "What are my people going to be responsible for? How is the world, the United States, going to respond to this? What about the United Nations? What about NATO? How do I start calling people together?" The 7 hours of isolation seemed an eternity for the man who could have been commander-in-chief. In 1995, Powell, 2 years retired from the Army, had considered running for president. Armitage had been passionately against it. "It's not worth it. Don't do it," he advised, finally telling his friend, "I don't think you're ready for this." The process of campaigning would be everything Powell hated, every bad thing you could imagine. Powell liked well-laid plans, order, predictability, a level of certainty that was not part of the hurly-burly of American politics. It was well known his wife, Alma, was opposed to his running. What was secret was that Alma had flatly told him that if he ran for president, she would leave him. "If you run, I'm gone," she said. She feared he would be attacked or shot. After Bush won the 2000 Republican presidential nomination, Powell signed on to help. But Karl Rove, Bush's chief political strategist, found that the campaign had to move heaven and earth to get him to appear at an event with Bush, as if Powell were protecting his centrist credentials and his own political future at Bush's expense. Nevertheless, he was an available vehicle to move Bush toward the center, and he became the almost certain choice for Secretary of State if Bush were elected. Powell let it be known this was a post he would accept. In his first months as Secretary of State, Powell had never really closed the personal loop with Bush, never established a comfort level, the natural at-ease state of closeness that both had with others. Rove was disturbed and felt Powell was beyond political control and operating out of a sense of entitlement. Whenever Powell was too out in front on an issue and became the public face of the administration, the political and communications operations at the White House reined him in, kept him out of the limelight. Rove and Karen P. Hughes, Bush's longtime communications director, now White House counselor, decided who from the administration would appear on the Sunday talk shows. If the White House didn't call to suggest that he accept the numerous invitations to appear, Powell knew the rules. He told the shows no. Powell and Armitage would joke that Powell had been put in the icebox or the refrigerator to be used only when needed. Just the week before September 11, Time magazine had done a cover story on Powell with the headline, "Where Have You Gone, Colin Powell?" The story said he was leaving shallow footprints on policy and losing out to administration hardliners. Powell and others in his circle had spent hours with the Time reporters unsuccessfully trying to talk them down from the storyline. The problem was that it was in part true. Powell was not formulating a foreign policy. He was getting assignments and reacting to one minor crisis after another. But as he once said in private, survival at the top is pragmatics. When he had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he had written out some of his favorite sayings and slipped them underneath the glass on his desk in the Pentagon. One said, "Never let them see you sweat." President Bush was reading to second graders at the Emma E. Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida, when Rove brought him the news that a plane had hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. At first, it seemed it might be an accident, pilot error, or maybe, Bush thought, the pilot had had a heart attack. He was sitting on a stool in the classroom, in a dark suit, blue shirt, and a bright red tie. A small blackboard behind him said, "Reading makes a country great." Andrew H. Carr, Jr., 55, Bush's chief of staff and a former White House aide to Reagan and Bush Sr., soon interrupted the president and whispered directly in his right ear, "A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack." A photo of that moment is etched for history. The president's hands are folded formally in his lap, his head turned to hear Card's words. His face has a distant, sober look, almost frozen, edging on bewilderment. Bush remembers exactly what he was thinking. "They had declared war on us, and I made up my mind at that moment that we were going to war." Bush decided that he needed to say something to the public. At 9:30 a.m., he appeared before the television cameras. Looking shaken, his language oddly informal, he promised that the full resources of the federal government would be employed to investigate and find those folks who committed this act. "Terrorism against our nation will not stand," he said, echoing the famous "this will not stand" formulation his father had used 11 years earlier when he faced his greatest challenge after Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990. Bush felt his father's declaration of resolve on the White House lawn several days after the invasion was among his finest moments as president. "Why I came up with those specific words, maybe it was an echo of the past," this president said later. "I don't know why. I'll tell you this, we didn't sit around massaging the words. I got up there and just spoke. What you saw was my gut reaction coming out." The president's motorcade raced to the Sarasota-Bradenton International Airport. He dashed up the steps and into his private front cabin and office on Air Force One. "Be sure to get the First Lady and my daughters protected," was his first order to the Secret Service agents. It was 9:39 a.m. when American Airlines Flight 77, a Boeing 757, slammed into the Pentagon. 5 minutes later, Bush reached his vice president, Dick Cheney, who had been whisked from his West Wing office by the Secret Service to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the emergency bunker beneath the White House grounds. "We're at war," Bush said, and told Cheney to give the congressional leadership a briefing. When the president hung up, he turned to some of his staff on Air Force One, who had heard his comment to Cheney. "That's what we're paid for, boys. We're going to take care of this. And when we find out who did this, they're not going to like me as president. Somebody is going to pay." Soon, Cheney was on the phone again to the president, urging that he authorize U.S. military aircraft to shoot down any additional commercial airliners that were controlled by hijackers. "You bet," Bush said. He gave the authority. At about 10:30 a.m., Cheney reached Bush again on Air Force One, which was still on its way to Washington. The White House had received a threat saying, "Angel is next." Since Angel was the code word for Air Force One, it could mean that terrorists had inside information. "We're going to find out who did this," Bush said to Cheney, "and we're going to kick their asses." Andrew Card, Bush's chief of staff, reported that First Lady Laura Bush was in a secure location with the Secret Service and that his daughters had been removed to safer locations. A few minutes later, Cheney was back on the phone, urging that the president not return to Washington. Signals intelligence and all kinds of reports were flooding in. Cheney immediately clicked into the possibility that the terrorist might be trying to decapitate the government, to kill its leaders. Bush recalled, "He was the man on the telephone who said, 'Do not come to Washington.'" The president agreed to divert to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. Somewhere around noon, Air Force One landed at Barksdale under heavy security. At 12:36, Bush issued another statement before the television cameras. His performance was not reassuring. He spoke haltingly, mispronouncing several words as he looked down at his notes. He seemed to gain strength at the end of the 219-word statement, promising resolve. "But make no mistake," he said. "We will show the world that we will pass this test." He told Card, "I want to go back home ASAP. I don't want whoever did this holding me outside of Washington." But the Secret Service said it was too unsteady in Washington, and Cheney said it was not safe yet. "The right thing is to let the dust settle," Card said. Bush reluctantly acquiesced and reboarded Air Force One, which shortly after 1:30 p.m. zoomed into the western sky, this time for Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. Offutt is home to the Strategic Command, which controls the United States' nuclear weapons, and the base has a facility to protect the president. He could also meet with his National Security Council over a secure video link. From the plane, Bush reached his Secretary of Defense, Donald H. Rumsfeld. "Wow, it was an American airliner that hit the Pentagon," the president said in some wonderment. "It's a day of national tragedy, and we'll clean up the mess, and then the ball will be in your court and Dick Myers' court." Air Force General Richard B. Myers, the tall, gentlemanly vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was slated to move up to become chairman, the top U.S. military position, in 3 weeks. Rumsfeld, a small-framed, almost boyish former Navy fighter pilot, who did not look his 69 years, had been expecting, even counting on, the order from the president putting the ball squarely in his court. Earlier in the year, when Rumsfeld was in discussions about becoming Bush's Secretary of Defense, he had had a talk with the president-elect, a little test of sorts. He told Bush that during the 8 years of Clinton, the natural pattern when challenged or attacked had been a reflexive pullback, caution, safety plays, even squeamishness. The Clinton weapon of choice was the standoff cruise missile. Rumsfeld left no doubt in Bush's mind that when that moment came, as it surely would, that the United States was threatened, he, as Secretary of Defense, would be coming to the president to unleash the military. The president could expect a forward-leaning action plan. Bush had replied, unambiguously in Rumsfeld's estimation, that that was precisely what he wanted. Rumsfeld believed they had a clear, common understanding. Rumsfeld's ascent to the inner circle of power is a story of intrigue, drive, and luck. In 1962, at the age of 30, Rumsfeld was elected to the first of four terms in Congress, representing the district of Chicago's North Shore suburbs, where he had grown up. By 1973-74, he was in Brussels, serving as U.S. ambassador to NATO, dodging the Watergate bullet. When Nixon resigned, Rumsfeld was asked to chair the presidential transition team of his former House colleague, Gerald Ford. Ford asked Rumsfeld to become White House chief of staff, but Rumsfeld wanted to stay at NATO. Rumsfeld agreed when Ford promised to streamline the staff and give Rumsfeld full authority. After a year in the White House, Ford told him he planned to fire Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. Rumsfeld would move to defense. CIA Director William Colby was going to be replaced by George Bush Sr., then the U.S. representative in China. Rumsfeld privately called the China post a crappy, irrelevant job. Rumsfeld was opposed to the new assignments for both Bush and himself. He told Ford that moving the two would put them on ice for Ford's upcoming presidential campaign. They were, he said, the only two who could give effective political speeches in the coming election year, 1976. But Rumsfeld saluted and took defense. Bush Sr. was convinced that Rumsfeld was secretly pushing him out to the CIA to end his political career. It seemed inconceivable at the time that the head of spying and dirty tricks abroad could ever become president. President Ford then elevated Rumsfeld's deputy, Dick Cheney, to be White House chief of staff. Over the next year, 1976, there emerged a subtle rivalry between Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and CIA Director Bush. In their years in the House, Rumsfeld had found Bush to be a lightweight who was interested in friendships, public relations, and public opinion polls more than substantive policy. In his view, Bush Sr. avoided controversy and sweat, except in the House gym. He went so far as to tell some that Bush had some of what Rumsfeld called the Rockefeller syndrome, available, wanting to serve, but not having clear goals. In Rumsfeld's world, having no larger purpose was almost a high crime. Rumsfeld believed that Bush was a weak CIA director who seriously underestimated the Soviet Union's military advances and was manipulated by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Rumsfeld went on to hold government appointments in the Reagan administration as Middle East envoy and in the Clinton administration as head of a commission to assess the ballistic missile threat to the U.S., but none in the administration of Bush Sr. Instead of being on a track to run for the presidency, Rumsfeld was now the Secretary of Defense for a second time, serving his longtime rival's son. In some respects, Rumsfeld was a walking example of the persistence of drive, hard work, and even stubbornness when ambition has not been fully realized. In his first 8 months back in the Pentagon, Rumsfeld struck two major themes. First, the military was hidebound and outdated, still equipped, trained, and organized to fight old enemies, mainly the Soviet Union. He undertook what he called transformation, to remake the force. And as he said somewhat presciently at his confirmation hearings, to develop capabilities to defend against missiles, terrorism, and new threats against our space assets and information systems. Rumsfeld's second theme was surprise. There is a tendency in our planning to confuse the unfamiliar with the improbable, a routine obsession with a few dangers that may be familiar rather than likely. Rumsfeld's transformation plans met with something just short of organized resistance, bordering on insubordination among a significant part of the senior uniformed officers. One four-star officer who worked with him said Rumsfeld was an egomaniac cleverly disguised, a hip shooter who gives the impression he's not. Woe to the briefer who presented only a proposed solution. "Wait, let's back up," Rumsfeld would often say. "I can read the answer. What I want to know is how you got there, the premise, the starting point, the full reasoning." This baffled the senior military. Rumsfeld confronted them with tough questions that seemed excessive. He seemed too confident in himself and too distrustful of his subordinates in the military. Rumsfeld didn't like muddling along. He didn't like imprecision, He redid or had suggestions on most memos. He hated loose language. If Rumsfeld rubbed the chiefs in the brass raw at times, many had respect for his intelligence. One senior general said, "I admire the man greatly, even though I don't necessarily like him. He's got a weakness in wanting to have his hands around everything, okay?" Aware of the attacks on the World Trade Center, Rumsfeld had been proceeding with his daily intelligence briefing in his office when the third hijacked plane struck the western face of the Pentagon. He went outside and followed the rising cloud of smoke to the crash site, helping with the rescue effort before a security agent urged him to get out of the area. "I'm going inside," Rumsfeld said, and hurried to the National Military Command Center, the large, heavily staffed Pentagon war room. It was filled with smoke, so he and his team went up to an isolated communications network room called Cables, where the air was better. General Myers urged Rumsfeld to leave. "We ought to think about moving." "Okay," Rumsfeld said, but kept on working. The military, which seemed to have contingency plans for the most inconceivable scenarios, had no plans for Afghanistan, the sanctuary of bin Laden and his network. There was nothing on the shelf that could be pulled down to provide at least an outline. This was not a surprise for the Secretary of Defense. Now he turned to Myers with a message. "When I've asked to see various plans, I've not been happy with what I've seen. They are neither imaginative nor creative. Clearly the plans are old and have been on the shelf for too long. We've got a long way to go." "I understand, sir," Myers replied. Rumsfeld finally left the war room and went to his office suite and set himself to working the problem. "This is the defining moment," he told his top aides. "The president is going to come back into town," he said, "and I need to be ready to talk to him when he arrives." He started jotting down ideas. He wanted thoughts from everyone, short concepts, statements of the problems. "Get this old paper, this report, this memo," he said. "Speak up. What did they have before them?" Victoria A. Torrey Clark, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, thought Rumsfeld was like a Vegas blackjack dealer, sitting in his massive office sorting through the paper, almost by instinct, setting out three stacks of memos, papers, and notes. 1. This is what we know. 2. This is what we're dealing with right now. 3. This is what we've got to deal with next, tomorrow, and into the long-term future. After several hours, Rumsfeld had it all down on a single sheet of paper. Nice, neat, no misspellings, no loose language, to take that night for a meeting at the White House with the president. He had a final question for General Myers. "Where are those plans?" At Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, President Bush convened at 3:30 p.m., the first meeting of the National Security Council for the terrorist crisis. Tenet reported with near certainty that bin Laden was behind the attacks. Passenger manifests showed 3 known al-Qaeda operatives had been on American Airlines Flight 77, which had plowed into the Pentagon. One of them, Khalid al-Madar, had come to the CIA's attention the previous year in Malaysia. A paid CIA spy had placed him at an al-Qaeda meeting. They had informed the FBI, who put him on a domestic watch list, but he had slipped into the United States over the summer and avoided detection by the Bureau. It was pretty obvious there had been some kind of screw-up, and it didn't sound to the president like the FBI and CIA were communicating. "George, get your ears up," the president told Tenet, meaning listen in on everything. FBI Director Robert S. Mueller III, who had only been in the job for a week, said they didn't know how the hijackers had taken over the planes. As a precaution, all air traffic over the U.S. had been grounded indefinitely. The president said he wanted to get the airlines flying again. "I'll announce more security measures," the president said, "but we won't be held hostage." And he added impulsively, "We'll fly at noon tomorrow." It would take 3 days before commercial airline flights resumed at a reduced schedule. "The terrorists can always attack," Rumsfeld said defiantly. "The Pentagon's going back to work tomorrow." Secret Service Director Brian L. Stafford addressed the president. "Our position is stay where you are," the director said. "It's not safe." "I'm coming back," Bush said. About 4:30 p.m., the president reached his wife on the phone. "I'm coming home," he said. "See you at the White House. Love you. Go on home." Bush wanted to give a speech that night to the nation on television. It included the sentences, "This is not just an act of terrorism, this is an act of war." This reflected what Bush had been saying all day to the National Security Council and his staff. "Take it out," Bush instructed Karen Hughes. "Our mission is reassurance." Bush said later, "I did not want to add to the angst of the American people yet." He wanted to go on television and be tough, show some resolve, but also find some balance, be comforting, demonstrate that the government was functioning, and show the nation that their president had made it through. There had been some doubt, as he had hopscotched most of the day from Air Force Base to Air Force Base. About 6:30 p.m., the president was finally back at the White House dealing with the speech draft, which said that in responding to terrorism, the United States would make no distinction between those who planned the acts and those who tolerated or encouraged the terrorists. "That's way too vague," Bush complained, proposing the word harbor. In final form, what would later be called the Bush Doctrine said, "We will make no distinction between those who planned these attacks and those who harbor them." It was an incredibly broad commitment to go after terrorists and those who sponsor and protect terrorists, rather than just a proposal for a targeted retaliatory strike. The decision was made without consulting Cheney, Powell, or Rumsfeld. The president did consult with his national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice. She wondered if that kind of far-reaching declaration and policy pronouncement belonged in a speech that was meant to console the shaken nation. But in the end, she favored including it that night because, she thought, first words matter more than almost anything else. "We've got to get it out there now," Bush said. It had been a policy he had been inching toward. Might as well say it. President Bush spoke to the nation for 7 minutes from the Oval Office. After the speech, he chaired an expanded National Security Council meeting that turned out to be unwieldy. So at 9:30 p.m., he gathered his most senior principal national security advisors in the White House bunker. It was at the end of one of the longest and most chaotic days in each of their lives. "This is the time for self-defense," the president said, making the somewhat obvious point. "We have made the decision to punish whoever harbors terrorists, not just the perpetrators." Powell, just back from Peru, said, "We have to make it clear to Pakistan and Afghanistan. This is showtime." Afghanistan's ruling Taliban regime, an extreme Islamic fundamentalist militia group which came to power in 1996, was harboring al-Qaeda terrorists in exchange for substantial bankrolling by bin Laden. Neighboring Pakistan's powerful intelligence service, the ISI, had had a giant role in creating the Taliban and keeping them in power. "This is a great opportunity," Bush said, somewhat locating the pony in the pile of manure. "It was a chance to improve relations, especially with big powers such as Russia and China. We have to think of this as an opportunity." The members of the War Cabinet had lots of questions, none more than Rumsfeld. On his single sheet of paper, he had the questions he thought the president and the rest of them needed to address and eventually answer. Who were the targets? How much evidence do we need before going after al-Qaeda? How soon do we act? "The sooner they acted," Rumsfeld said, "the more public support they would have if there's collateral damage." He was being careful. Since the military had no plan and no forces in the immediate area, he wanted to keep expectations low. He dropped a bomb, telling them that some major strikes could take up to 60 days to put together. The notion of waiting 60 days for something major, until November 11th, perhaps, just hung in the room. Rumsfeld had more questions. Powell thought they were a clever disguise, a way to argue rhetorically and avoid taking a position. Still, the questions were good, and Rumsfeld went on. "Are there targets that are off limits? Do we include the American allies in any military strikes?" Last, the Secretary of Defense said, "We have to set declaratory policy, announce to the world what we're doing." Cheney noted that Afghanistan would present a real challenge. A primitive country 7,000 miles away with a population of 26 million, it was the size of Bush's home state of Texas, but had few roads and little infrastructure. Finding anything to hit would be hard. The president returned to the problem of the Al-Qaeda terrorists and their sanctuary in Afghanistan. "We have to deny Al-Qaeda sanctuary," Tenet said. "Tell the Taliban we're finished with them." The Taliban and Al-Qaeda were really the same. Rumsfeld said that they should employ every tool of national power, not just the military, but legal, financial, diplomatic, and the CIA. Tenet said that Al-Qaeda, though headquartered in Afghanistan, operated worldwide, on all continents. "We have a 60-country problem," he said. "Let's pick them off one at a time," the president said. Rumsfeld, not to be outdone in identifying difficulties, said the problem was not just bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but other countries that supported terrorism. "We have to force countries to choose," Bush said. The meeting was adjourned. The president, untested and untrained in national security, was about to start on the complicated and prolonged road to war, without much of a map. Condoleezza Rice went to the National Security Advisor's office in the corner of the West Wing after the meeting. A former Stanford political science professor, and then provost, she had worked on the National Security Council staff as a Russian expert during the presidency of Bush Sr. Rice, 46, was perhaps the person in the upper reaches of Bush's national security team who was most alone. Her mother was dead, and her father had died a year ago. Following the attacks that morning, she called the only family she had, her aunt and uncle in Birmingham, Alabama, to tell them she was all right, then went back to work. Beginning in the presidential campaign when she was Bush's chief foreign policy advisor, Rice had developed a very close relationship with Bush. The president and first lady had, in a sense, become her family. That night, she acknowledged to herself that she was in a fog. She tried to focus on what had to be done the next day. If it was bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the questions would sooner or later arise about what the Bush administration knew about the bin Laden threat, when they knew it, and what they had done about it. About a week before Bush's inauguration, Rice attended a meeting at Blair House, across from the White House, with President-elect Bush and Vice President-elect Cheney. This was the secrets briefing given by Tenet and James L. Pavitt, the CIA Deputy Director for Operations. For 2.5 hours, Tenet and Pavitt had run through the good, the bad, and the ugly about the CIA to a fascinated president-elect. Tenet and Pavitt presented bin Laden as one of the three top threats facing the United States. The other two were the increasing availability of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear, including weapons proliferation concerns, and the rise of Chinese power, military and other. In April, the National Security Council Deputies Committee, made up of the number twos in each major department and agency, recommended that President Bush adopt a policy that would include a serious effort to arm the Northern Alliance, the loose confederation of various warlords and tribes in Afghanistan that opposed the Taliban regime that harbored bin Laden. But worries about the Northern Alliance abounded. First, it was not really an alliance, because the various warlords could probably with some ease be bought off by the Taliban. In addition, the Russians and Iranians, who both supported the alliance with substantial amounts of money, had strong influence with some of the warlords. During July, the Deputies Committee recommended a comprehensive plan, not just to roll back Al-Qaeda, but to eliminate it. It was a plan that would give the CIA $125 million to $200 million a year to arm the alliance. Rice had a national security presidential directive ready to go to the president on September 10. The door had been opened, and they were ready to walk through it. The question that would always linger was whether they had moved fast enough on a threat that had been identified by the CIA as one of the top three facing the country, whether September 11 was as much a failure of policy as it was of intelligence. At 11:08 p.m., September 11, the Secret Service awakened the Bushes and hurriedly escorted them to the bunker. An unidentified plane seemed to be heading for the White House. The president was in his running shorts and a T-shirt. Mrs. Bush was in her robe and without her contact lenses. Their dogs Spot and Barney scampered along. In the long tunnel leading to the bunker, they met Card, Rice, and Stephen J. Hadley, the Deputy National Security Advisor, who were racing along. The errant plane was soon identified, but the Secret Service still wanted the President to spend the night in the bunker. Bush looked at the small bed and announced he was going back to the residence. Like his father during his White House years, the President tried to keep a daily diary of some thoughts and observations. He dictated that night, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today." Bush would recall that he had two thoughts. This was a war in which people were going to have to die. Secondly, I was not a military tactician. I recognized that. I was going to have to rely on the advice and counsel of Rumsfeld, Shelton, Myers, and Tenet. He was now a wartime president. Soldiers and citizens, the entire world, would pick up instantly on his level of engagement, energy, and conviction. The widely held view that he was a lightweight, unconcerned with details, removed, aloof, and possibly even ignorant, would have to be dispelled. He had much work to do. Vice President Dick Cheney, who had been the efficient, solid rock standing behind or to the side of President Bush during the first 9 months of the administration, anticipated he would have a major role in the crisis. Heavy-set, balding, with a trademark tilted head and a sly, knowing smile, the 61-year-old Cheney, a conservative hardliner, had been training all his life for such a war. His credentials were impeccable. At 34, White House Chief of Staff to President Ford, Congressman from Wyoming for 10 years, rising to become the number two House Republican leader, Defense Secretary to the first President Bush during the Persian Gulf War. On the morning of Wednesday, September 12th, Cheney had a moment alone with Bush. "Should someone chair a kind of war cabinet for you of the principles? We'll develop options and report to you. It might streamline decision-making." "No," Bush said, "I'm going to do that, run the meetings." This was a commander-in-chief function. It could not be delegated. He also wanted to send the signal that it was he who was calling the shots, that he had the team in harness. He would chair the full National Security Council meetings, and Rice would continue to chair the separate meetings of the principals when he was not attending. Cheney would be the most senior of the advisors. Without a department or agency such as State, Defense, or the CIA, Cheney was minister without portfolio. It was a lesser role than he had perhaps expected. But he, as much as any of the others, knew the terms of presidential service. Salute and follow orders. President Bush, like many members of his national security team, believed the Clinton administration's response to Osama bin Laden and international terrorism, especially since the embassy bombings in 1998, had been so weak as to be provocative, a virtual invitation to hit the United States again. "The antiseptic notion of launching a cruise missile into some guy's, you know, tent really is a joke," Bush said later in an interview. "I mean, people viewed that as the impotent America, a flaccid, you know, kind of technologically competent but not very tough country that was willing to launch a cruise missile out of a submarine, and that'd be it. I do believe there's an image of America out there that we are so materialistic, that we're almost hedonistic, that we don't have values, and that when struck, we wouldn't fight back." It was clear that bin Laden felt emboldened and didn't feel threatened by the United States. Until September 11th, however, Bush had not put that thinking into practice, nor had he pressed the issue of bin Laden. Though Rice and the others were developing a plan to eliminate al-Qaeda, no formal recommendations had ever been presented to the President. "I know there was a plan in the works. I don't know how mature the plan was," Bush recalled. He said the idea that a plan was going to be on his desk September 10th was perhaps a convenient date. "It would have been odd to come September the 10th because I was in Florida on September the 10th, so I don't think they would have been briefing me in Florida." He acknowledged that bin Laden was not his focus or that of his national security team. "There was a significant difference in my attitude after September 11th. I was not on point, but I knew he was a menace and I knew he was a problem. I knew he was responsible, or we felt he was responsible, for the previous bombings that killed Americans. I was prepared to look at a plan that would be a thoughtful plan, that would bring him to justice, and would have given the order to do that. I have no hesitancy about going after him. but I didn't feel that sense of urgency, and my blood was not nearly as boiling. At 8 a.m., September 12th, Tenet arrived at the Oval Office for the President's daily brief, the top-secret code word digest of the most important and sensitive intelligence. This briefing included a review of available intelligence tracing the attacks to bin Laden and his top associates in Al-Qaeda. For Tenet, the evidence on bin Laden was conclusive, game, set, match. He then turned to the agency's capabilities on the ground in Afghanistan. Though an expanded covert action plan had been in the works for months, Tenet told Bush an even more expanded plan would soon be presented for approval, and it would be expensive, very expensive. Though Tenet did not use a figure, it was going to approach $1 billion. "Whatever it takes," the president said. After the intelligence briefing, Bush met with Hughes. He told her that he wanted a daily meeting to shape the administration's message to Americans about the fight against terrorism. "Let's get the big picture," Bush said. "A faceless enemy has declared war on the United States of America, so we are at war." They needed a plan, a strategy, even a vision, he said, to educate the American people to be prepared for another attack. Americans needed to know that combating terrorism would be the main focus of the administration and the government from this moment forward. Hughes returned to her corner office on the second floor of the West Wing to begin drafting a statement. Before she could open a new file on her computer, Bush summoned her. "Let me tell you how to do your job today," he told her when she arrived at the Oval Office. He handed her two pieces of White House notepaper with three thoughts scratched out in his handwriting. "This is an enemy that runs and hides, but won't be able to hide forever. An enemy that thinks its havens are safe, but won't be safe forever. No kind of enemy that we are used to, but America will adapt." Hughes went back to work. Bush convened his National Security Council in the Cabinet Room and declared that the time for reassuring the nation was over. He said he was confident that if the administration developed a logical and coherent plan, the rest of the world would rally to our side. At the same time, he was determined not to allow the threat of terrorism to alter the way Americans lived their lives. "We have to prepare the public without alarming the public." FBI Director Mueller began to describe the investigation underway to identify the hijackers. He said it was essential not to taint any evidence so that if accomplices were arrested, they could be convicted. Attorney General John D. Ashcroft interrupted. "Let's stop the discussion right here," he said. "The chief mission of U.S. law enforcement is to stop another attack and apprehend any accomplices or terrorists before they hit us again. If we can't bring them to trial, so be it." Ashcroft was saying the focus of the FBI and the Justice Department should change from prosecution to prevention, a radical shift in priorities. After he finished with the National Security Council, Bush continued meeting with the half-dozen principals who comprised the War Cabinet. Powell said the State Department was ready to carry the president's message, "You're either with us or you're not," to Pakistan and the Taliban. Bush responded that he wanted a list of demands for the Taliban. "Handing over bin Laden is not enough," he told Powell. He wanted the whole Al-Qaeda organization